welcome to the Sound of Economics podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic policy think tank. I'm Gunther Wolf, the director of Bruegel, and today I will host our director's cut with Ashoka Modi, professor for economics, political economy at Princeton University. Welcome, Ashoka.
Thank you very much, Gundram. Always a pleasure to be back at Bruegel.
Well, Ashoka, thank you for being here and for discussing today with us your new book, The Euro Tragedy. It's been a book many years in the making. You've visited also Bruegel several times while writing the book. We have discussed many times some of the chapters in the book. And so I'm absolutely delighted and pleased to host you today to talk about this book. And perhaps to start with, why don't you give our listeners a view and an idea of what are the key messages in your book?
Thank you very much, Gundram. And I just want to also acknowledge the fact that I've been here many times, and my association with Bruegel has been enormously productive, fruitful in how this book has evolved. So the central thesis of the book is that the euro as a single currency was known to create economic divergence between nations of a single currency area. It was known that a single monetary policy can be too strong or too tight for some countries and too weak or too easy for some countries. That encourages or stimulates divergence across countries. But the political implication of that is what I really emphasize. The economics is understood that if there is economic divergence and the euro or a single currency contributes and amplifies that economic divergence, then the political divisions will grow. And my central thesis, therefore, is that although the euro was sold as an instrument that would create political unity, it was always understood by those who were critics of the eurozone that it would actually create political division. And Nicholas Calder, the great British economist, wrote in 1971 that a eurozone, or what would be eventually called a eurozone, would be like a house divided which cannot stand. And I think Calder's ghost is today stalking the eurozone.
Well, one of your chapters discusses Kohl and how Helmut Kohl, the German chancellor of German reunification, thought of the euro as the project that would eventually bring Europe together, that would, in a sense, be the right counterpart to German reunification. With German reunification, it became clear that Germany would become a strong country, a stronger country than it was before, and a country that historically was for a long time actually always too big and too small for Europe. So it was too big in the sense that it was not just one among many, but it was too small to really dominate the continent. And so Kohl's vision was by entering the eurozone, Germany would be permanently bound in a political project and ultimately would surrender and, share some of the political and fiscal sovereignty with its partners, and especially France. Now, I think your thesis is that Kohl was spectacularly wrong. So where are we in this history?
So I think Kohl was spectacularly wrong, not in retrospect. Kohl was spectacularly wrong at the time. Kohl, I think, understood and recognized many of the pitfalls that we are now seeing. There was no reason for Kohl to expect that there would be a sharing of sovereignty, because in Kohl's own actions, there was a clear sense that sovereignty would not be shared. The euro that Kohl made possible, in fact, my claim is that but for Kohl, there would have been no euro. the coal that the euro that coal made possible was designed to create a set of fiscal rules which were a signal to the rest of the eurozone, not just a signal, in a statement to the Bundestag in 1998, he says Germany will not pay the bills for other countries. And he repeats that statement. So right at the outset, Kohl has made clear that he is not going to share fiscal sovereignty. He has also bypassed the German citizen for 8 years, from 1990 to 1998. Kohl fought 3 elections, and at no stage did Kohl canvass the people of Germany to say to the Germans that the euro is not just in the European interest, it is ultimately in the German interest. He could never make that case because he knew if he made that case, the Germans would probably rebel against him. And so he never made the case. So as long as a German chancellor does not make that case to the German people that the euro is ultimately good for Europe and for them, and that a system of sharing fiscal sovereignty is ultimately beneficial for everybody, there will never be fiscal sovereignty. Kohl, I think, completely understood that. And Kohl therefore created a legacy within which an incomplete monetary union, one that does not recognize that a single monetary policy does not work for all countries. Therefore, some of the weaker countries need some fiscal transfers of a reasonably significant magnitude. Kohl not only bequeathed that, but Kohl bequeathed 2 other very important legacies. One was Italian entry into the Eurozone. There was a very, very strong view in the German establishment, right up to 1997-98, which said that Italy did not belong in the Eurozone. And if it had not been for Chancellor Kohl, Italy would certainly not have been in the original membership and probably never have been in a member of the Eurozone, which would meant that Spain, Portugal, and Greece would also not have been in the Eurozone. The second more subtle and more, in a sense, more harmful legacy of Kohl is that he created this rhetoric, this narrative that the euro was an instrument for European peace. Mm-hmm. And he made it a point in almost every speech of his on the euro to end or to begin or to say in some form that anybody who opposed the euro was anti-European, was nationalistic, who was a warmonger. And so he created a narrative that the euro was an instrument for something which it never was. And the logic of the euro created divisions, not unity. And so Kohl had a very corrosive legacy that he bequeathed. You know, in retrospect, a lot of people look back at Kohl and say, well, he was this great man who had this great vision. But in my reading of the history, Kohl never had a sense of how he would ever be able to materialize that vision.
Well, I certainly remember very much the time, the Kohl time, which was sort of the time when I was a teenager and grew up. And I remember how much Helmut Kohl pushed the euro against and the sharing of monetary sovereignty against the will of basically large parts of the conservative parts of German society. I think perhaps in his view there was the view also that you know, these big historical decisions would not be taken by citizens but would be taken by great chancellors, and he would push that decision now, and the next German chancellor, whoever that would have been, would then, when things come to a crunch point, make the case and push to the next level of political integration, which I think was a little bit his view at the time. He probably underestimated the forces also of opposition that in the country, in Germany, certainly have mobilized over the decades. on the fiscal risk sharing in particular. And certainly he was himself very critical of the German Chancellor Merkel and her, I think, as he called it, lack of compass as to where Europe should be going.
Yeah, I think I would be very reluctant to give any concession to Kohl as having a view that eventually a future German chancellor would solve this problem. The hand that Kohl dealt future German chancellors was such a difficult one that was impossible for any German chancellor to be able to reverse what Kohl had done. Remember that Kohl himself in 1990, at the height of his power, at the time when he was being lauded quite rightly as being Chancellor of German Unity, he had enormous political capital. He never used that political capital to push the project that he felt that future German chancellors would do. He did not push it in 1994. He did not push it in 1998. In fact, in 1998, Guntram, you may remember that Gerhard Schroeder was calling the euro a premature sickly baby.
Yes, I remember.
And at that point, because Kohl knew that he was in a weak position, Kohl began to adopt some of Gerhard Schroeder's rhetoric and sort of reclaim a certain degree of German nationalism as part of what Germany is, and that Germany will not be subordinate to Europe. That was part of the language that crept into Kohl's campaign speeches. So when he started criticizing Angela Merkel in 2010 and 2011, I felt that Kohl was trying to have his cake and eat it too. He had not done what he had to do. And Chancellor Merkel, there are lots of problems with this Chancellor Merkel style, that you know she takes time to make decisions. Time making decisions, those delays are very costly. But I think what Merkel was trying to do was to balance two objectives, to be sensitive to what she believed was the German public's priority, as well as saving Europe. And unfortunately, this is the dialectic. I see Merkel as part of a broader dialectic rather than as somebody who has the same stature and same executive autonomy that Kohl enjoyed. She is caught in a historical process within which she was dealt a hand, a crisis comes. She then has the option of going to the German public and making the statement that Kohl never made. And she is not in a position to do that. And as long as she cannot do that, laying out the fiscal resources of the German taxpayer become impossible for her. I therefore have some sympathy for Chancellor Merkel's conduct, and I call my book a tragedy because even though I can have sympathy for her, I realize how tragic the outcome is. Mm. Because Merkel's actions during 2011 and 12 become the source of political division. Even as Merkel is holding the Eurozone together through the ESM and her backing of the OMT, look at the political forces she's unleashing. In Italy and Greece, there is a violent reaction, violent in the sense of a very crude reaction, but nevertheless a very strong reaction to what is believed to be the German diktat. That becomes part of the campaign process of Silvio Berlusconi, that sees the rise of the five-star movement. An anti-Europe force develops an enormous political momentum in 2012 and 13. And paradoxically, the same actions that the Italians see as creating a subordinate a role for them in Europe, the AfD sees as Merkel doing too much for Europe. The AfD is born almost at the same time as the five-star movement gains political momentum in Italy. And so the political divisions that were inherent in the project come out of the crucible of the darkest period of the Eurozone crisis.
Well, I mean, I certainly agree with you that Chancellor Merkel inherited an intrinsically difficult problem from Helmut Kohl, and that Helmut Kohl was somewhat disingenuous in his approach thinking, and to especially in his interviews in 2011, sort of putting all the blame on Mrs. Merkel. That was certainly not the right approach. Having said that, I also agree that Mrs. Merkel was trying to balance the various forces of European integration and, of course, the divisions and the opposition within Germany to many of the things that would be needed to save the euro. Still, I feel that there were windows where more could have done and where also political support was stronger. I mean, the political support of Mrs. Merkel is now at the lowest, and it's only now that she tries to sort of at least move a little bit vis-à-vis Emmanuel Macron, even though the Meseberg agreement, I think, is falls well short of what is needed, and this is mostly paying lip service on the true issues. But still, there is at least some movement. And she moved, I mean, the big thing where she moved is, of course, the ESM and then the OMT. And the OMT was absolutely fundamental, and she supported Mario Draghi in this against large parts of the German public. So I guess the historical question that will probably be answered by future generations of historians, I mean, was there a window in 2011, perhaps, or 2012, where more could have been done at a moment when Chancellor Merkel was actually at the height of her power? I mean, between 2012, 11 and 14, she was at the height of her power. So why could she not have shaped more the discourse at that time?
I think you're posing exactly the right historical question. In 2011 and 12, she held the Eurozone together through the ESM and the OMT. I 100% agree. I think her great opportunity was the 2013 election. This was a moment where the Merkel factor, it was not just that the CDU won because Merkel had an independent stature in Germany. And this was a moment in history when she could have used that political capital to do something more than what she was ready to do. The question I think historians will want to ask is why in the 2013 election she did not make the German sense of self-interest in Europe a campaign issue. Could she have said to the German people, look, right now we need to help other countries because being in a better Europe is ultimately fundamentally better for Germany? That was the moment, because that was at the height of her popularity. And that was a moment also because the general European public was very tired of the crisis, mm-hmm. and would have given her the legitimacy both in Europe and in Germany to be able to do that. Once she did not do that, once she missed that window, I think the 2017 election, she had already lost the battle. And so she is now way too weak to make any credible commitment to Europe.
Yes, I think I agree with that. And perhaps what I want to add is in 2013, I did write a little policy brief, which I called Memo to Chancellor Merkel, where I laid out some of the things that I think would have been a good agenda, which I think now are actually much more difficult to achieve than they were at the time because of her political weakness. Which, in a sense, and there perhaps I differ a little bit with you, is probably much more related to the migration crisis and the decisions on migration in 2015 than to the Eurozone itself. I mean, the Euro and the AfD, Alternative für Deutschland, was founded as an anti-Euro party, but never gained any ground on the anti-Euro ticket. I mean, the party gained popularity on the migration ticket, which is a, I mean, it's related in the sense that it is about shaping European responses to a common problem, but it's pretty unrelated to the euro itself. So I think there perhaps I take a slightly different view. Perhaps my last question to you, Ashoka, is on the role of social democracy. You write quite a bit in your book and also in various blog posts about social democracy in Europe and of course the SPD in Germany in particular. Perhaps you can share your views and insights there.
So the question I ask myself is that if the economics of the Eurozone is inherently divisive because it helps the stronger countries, creates an additional burden on the weaker countries, which fosters political divisions, then is it the case that broader European values of an open society and social justice can become the focal point around which Europeans could come together and say, this is ultimately our idealism, this is what unites us, and work backwards from that idealism to say, in order to achieve that idealism, we need to be able to have a sense of give and take which is greater than the one we are now doing. And my claim is that the Social Democrats are most naturally positioned to do that because that is part of their political mandate. That is the rationale, the raison d'etre for social democrats to exist, is to promote social justice and an open society. And the unfortunate thing is that to be able to, the Social Democrats have become intellectually lazy. To be able to fulfill their mission, they have to recognize that first and foremost, they have to bring their domestic constituencies to the table through a culturally and politically sensitive catering to the needs of those who are within the country, those who are feeling left behind. From the time of Gerhard Schroeder's so-called middle way or center way, social democrats have created divisions within the working class by creating a class of workers who is more privileged and another class that is less privileged. That has seen the growth of social inequalities, intergenerational mobility has become weaker. So social democrats do not have national constituencies on which to build on to create a stronger case for Europe. And all through Europe, that has become the fundamental fault line of social democrats. Therefore, the role of the German SPD becomes particularly important because the German SPD not only is not able to do enough for itself to generate a domestic political constituency, at the European level, it takes a very German view in terms of labor market reforms. It still peddles the idea that Hartz reforms, type reforms, are the only right way for other countries, whereas I feel that not only did the Hartz reform do considerable social harm in Germany, they inflict equal, if not greater, harm in other countries, and ultimately do not even raise productivity growth. And German social democrats also take a completely nationalistic view on the budget. And you see that with Peer Steinbrück and with Olaf Scholz. They have a very rigid view of what the German ministers, German finance ministers' obligation is to Germany rather than to Europe. And so neither on the domestic front nor on the European front the SPD has been able to take a leadership role. And if the SPD cannot take a leadership role, then with the secular decline of social democracy in any case through Europe, this becomes an enormously difficult task. And I fear that we may have actually passed this window. We may have reached a point of no return, that social democracy as it stands today will probably not recover in the political in the structure of the parties as they currently exist. I expect that if social democracy as a movement reemerges, it will be through different vehicles.
Well, we could continue to discuss this for hours and, of course, start thinking and speculating about the future, because, of course, we are not at the end of history here. We are at a moment where still very important decisions are being taken, be it on migration, be it on trade policies, be it on how to respond to the rise of less liberal forces or anti-liberal forces in the United States, in the UK. All of these developments certainly will shape European politics and make it also somewhat unpredictable. And, I think it can go in many directions. So I don't want to end this on a totally pessimistic note. I do think there is some momentum for European countries to move closer to each other, to work together on some of the key issues on which I think we have to work together. Such as trade policies, such as defense, such as migration. And these things, in the end, shape what makes up a political unity also. I mean, so if you succeed on some of these things, there is an upside here that will allow to rebuild trust, which then, in the end, will help us move closer together on some of the more difficult issues on the euro. But, of course, that is basically speculation at this stage, and we don't know how history will unfold, but I think it's basically history in the making that we are seeing and working on and discussing here, and we could discuss that, I think, for hours more. And so let me end this podcast by thanking you, Ashoka, very much for your insights and for coming today to discuss this book with you. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you very much, Mundra. Very much appreciated.
Thank you.